From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1979 when a Republican named Charles Willis was elected to Monroe County Family Court. Might have seemed like not very big of an event at the time, but for nearly 40 years, Willis was the only person of color elected to the county bench. That changed in 2018 when voters elected Fatima Reed. And by the way, she was the first woman of color ever elected to the county bench. Throughout that campaign, Reed said that it was not an election only about race, but she said that the history shouldn't be ignored and representation matters. When we sat down with Judge Reed after her election in 2018, she told us that her election came with a sense of responsibility and weight. And now, 7 years later, there is an ascendant cultural movement that says enough about identity. There's too much focus on race or gender or sexual identity. Choose candidates, choose leaders, they say, based on merit alone, no matter who that person is. I've been clear on this program. I think we need to separate that cultural critique into two groups. The first is the group that says they only care about hiring the best. They are colorblind. And then they hire Pete Hegseth to run the largest military in the history of the world. And they hire Laura Trump to be the new weekend anchor at Fox News. And they have given away the game. There is a second group, though, including people like the author Thomas Chatterton Williams, who do think that the last decade leaned too heavily on identity in all corners of American life. They don't want to return to 1950, but they think a course correction is necessary. And so with DEI under assault and with a countercultural force in the halls of power, there are questions about what comes next. The 7th Judicial District has its own DEI framework, and leaders in the courts have worked on various initiatives to try to create a system that is more representative of the community it serves. This hour, we're talking about those efforts, particularly with the backdrop of what's happening in Washington and in the broader culture. And we'll tell you about some events on the calendar, including a film event coming up at the Little Theater. Let me welcome my guests, and it's an honor to have the Honorable Fatima Reed back with us. Judge Reed is with the Monroe County Family Court. It is nice to see you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Honorable Van White. I don't know that I've gotten to say that. It's been a while, Judge.
I don't think you have.
Rochester City Court Judge. Well, judges aren't on this program all that often, I have to say, Judge White. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Good to be back, Evan.
Andre Washington is treasurer of the Rochester Black Bar Association. Thank you for making time for the program as well.
I'm excited to be here.
The event, the first event we're talking about, by the way, is coming up. Oh, my goodness. Next Tuesday is, that's 6 days away. February 18th, Tuesday. That is starting at 5:45 at the Little Theater. It's a free community screening of Greenwood is Still Burning. That's a documentary recounting the 1921 Tulsa race massacre and the impact on Black Wall Street. There will be a panel event, as there often is at the Little, and they would love to see you at the Little. Again, that's February the 18th coming up. And then 8 days later, February 26th, event just after noontime at the Hall of Justice. Judge Reed, what's that event all about?
And that event, this year's theme for Black History Month is African American and labor. And so at that event, which we coin our flagship event, our last event, culminating a whole month of very robust, engaging educational programs at the Hall of Justice. And so we're going to have a dynamic panel of labor leaders in our community, African-American labor leaders who will share some history with us in terms of labor organization and then where these organizations see in the backdrop of what is going on nationally, where they see the labor movement in the African-American community going.
And I know the event next Tuesday is co-sponsored by the Rochester Black Bar Association. Is that right?
That is correct. We are excited to be a part of this with the Hall of Justice.
So those are the events on the calendar. We'll have information in our show notes if listeners want to check out those events as part of Black History Month. Let me just pull back a little, and I want to start with Judge Reed. And I went back and I listened to our conversation. And it felt a little bit like it was an artifact from a different world. Conversations about representation, it felt a little bit more rote and placid, like it was a logical thing to discuss as opposed to something inherently incendiary. What do you make of this current moment, Judge?
Well, I can say this. I can talk about what the New York State court system is doing and what the 7th Judicial District in particular is doing. What some of our community may not know that our then Chief Judge of the New York State Courts, she commissioned a report back in 2020 in light of a lot of unrest to see where our courts were in terms of access to justice and equal justice, and if our courts really were representative of the community that we served. And former attorney with our then President Barack Obama, Jay Johnson, he commissioned that report. He interviewed many employees from upstate to downstate to New York City to learn what the state of our, we took an inventory of what is the state of our court system. Are we truly inclusive? Are we truly making sure that we had access to justice and equal justice for all? And so after that report was concluded and there were 13 recommendations proffered by Jay Johnson, we saw that there was much work that needed to be done in our court systems. And so with that, our now Chief Judge, Rowan Wilson, our Deputy Chief Judge of Access to Justice and Equal Justice, Edwina Richardson, they've all sort of left it to the districts to figure out how do we implement those recommendations that were in the Jay Johnson report, our Equal Justice report, and then how do we make our court system and truly welcoming to all. And not some. We've had some, we've had some interesting things that have happened within our court systems. We've certainly had issues related to race in our court systems. And so for the 7th Judicial District, we organized a committee called Embracing Our Community, in which I lead as the 2 years ago, our administrative judge, Bill Taylor, appointed me to be the district-wide coordinating judge for diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm the only one in New York State, Evan. And so we were hoping more districts would be fearless and appoint judges to take a systematic approach in how we're dealing with access to justice and equal justice in light of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Right now, just the letters DEI might spark a pretty passionate response, given what's happening in the culture and in politics. I know there may be some limitations to what you can say. I'm used to interviewing retired judges who can speak more freely. So I want to say to our guests, I'm grateful that they're here, and I understand that there may be some limitations, and we respect that. So, you know, put a brake on anything that you can't feel like, you places you can't go. But I'll ask you, Judge Reed, I mean, right now, you look around and you say, you feel proud of the work that feels bold and important. And many people in the halls of power are saying, no, this work is not necessary. This work is leading us down the road of obsessing about race, that that we need to find a different path that doesn't talk so much about this, that makes it feel like it's obsessive in our culture. What do you think of that?
Well, what I say is I think there is too much. I think that we have to think more broadly. It's not only about race. There's, women who should have access to certain tables. There are people with disabilities who we should make sure that they have access. There are people who are non-English speakers who we should also make sure that we have access and equal justice. And so that's what I think. I think that some people want to center the narrative on race. And to be quite truthful, they want to center that on people that look like me or African Americans and want to talk about whether we're qualified. I want to assure you, anyone, including myself, who has attained certain things, like me becoming the first African American woman to be elected countywide, I am very proud of that title. I was very qualified to run and to sit on the bench. And so while I know the narrative may be centered on race, it's much more. DEI is much more than race and much more than giving African Americans an opportunity.
Judge White.
Yes, sir.
Some general comments from you before we kind of get a little bit more granular here. You've been in politics in your career. Now you're on the bench. What do you make of this political moment?
Well, for context, as you may recall, Evan, on a number of occasions in this very studio, we talked about diversity in the context of my legal practice. Mm-hmm. For 30 years, I practiced in the area of civil rights litigation. So I've seen some of this stuff on and off the bench. I've seen discrimination and the lack of diversity or lack of tolerance, not only in the courtroom, but also in the boardroom. And so for me, this conversation about should we talk about diversity and inclusion and equity is a non-starter. I think we have to talk about that. But more importantly than talking about it, I think we have to do stuff about it. Let me say, by way of example, piggyback on what Judge Reed just said. There's a judge in Albany. Her name is Andre Ackerman, I believe her name is. And she started this program called UCAN. It's basically a mentoring court. But why she started that program is, and she talks openly about it, her background, not only as a woman, but as a person who came up as a child in a very difficult, challenging environment, prompted her to create a mentoring court, which she got a lot of pushback for it. And the reason behind the pushback relates to the lack of understanding of the importance of diversity. That court now exists in Albany, it exists in Buffalo, and we're right on the verge of starting one here in Rochester. My point being, as Judge Reed said, this is more than just about diversity in terms of the color of your skin. It's about diversity of experience. You know, I think Judge Reed has done a good job, a very good job at creating a committee that is inclusive. And so I don't think she just looks at me as a black man. I think she looks at me as a former civil rights lawyer. I think she looks at me, and I don't think many people can avoid it, looks at me as someone who had some experience on the school board, right? Those experiences, like Judge Ackerman's experiences, my experience with my father as an African-American man, very much drives how I look at other African-American men in the courtroom. I'll be honest with you. And I would be lying to anybody who suggests otherwise. So that diversity enhances everyone's experience. And so, but again, it doesn't have to be an acronym. It doesn't have to be an initiative. It just should happen. And I'm on the bench, and I'm not pushing programs for black men or women. I'm doing things naturally that come from my experiences. So, you know, I'll call out his name. Donald Trump has experiences that I do not have, right? His cabinet has experiences that I don't have. Diversity is about ensuring that the American experience is part of the government experience. And so it's not just an educational experience that people get when they put me on the bench.
But let me just follow this point before I turn to your colleague across the table here.
Yeah.
I think part of what we are seeing is in bad faith, and there's part, I think, that they maybe have some genuine questions and that I think are worth exploring. Here's the bad faith part that I think is dangerous. I want to read a quote from 13 months ago. This is January 2024. And listeners who don't know Charlie Kirk, he is one of the most culturally influential figures in the young Republican and conservative movement. He said on his show, quote, "If I see a black pilot, I'm going to be like, boy, I hope he's qualified." The way that lands with me is, it is obviously racist. And it implies that if I see a white pilot, no problem. I'm sure he's qualified. If I see anybody else, I just assume that they got the job in some kind of a quota. That maybe they're qualified, but also maybe not. The default is the dudes who look like him. And I think that's intentional. So that's why I think we should differentiate, you know, some of when we talk about merit, we talk about, you know, understanding your experience. I'm not perfect. I don't look at Van White and think, well, Van White is, you know, was selected to be a candidate because of his identity. If you didn't have the merit, I never assume that the merit isn't there. But there's a growing number of people who are framing it as black means a diversity hire or a DEI hire automatically.
Yeah, but Evan, can I say, for a black man, I don't know about Fatima. I don't know about the Black Bar Association, members of the Black Bar Association. That's nothing new. That is nothing. I mean, you all are having this mind-blowing experience. Oh, my God. They think of you as – that's how I talk about my father and my mother. That's how we were raised. We were raised to understand that we had to be one up better than anybody else. We've heard that phrase. So I'm qualified. Fatima's qualified. We're all qualified to have these jobs. Many people, no offense, I love you, Evan, but it's a mind-blowing experience that, oh my gosh, they don't think you're qualified. We've been hearing this for years, and we fight against that every day. So for you and others, and you're not the only person I've heard say that, it's this new dialogue. Oh my gosh, they're thinking that we're less than, you know, and I'm not saying that's right, it's wrong. But I've been hearing that every day as a child, as a young man, as a lawyer, as a father.
it doesn't frame my mindset because I've been hearing it every day.
No, I take your point. I think what I really want to make sure I'm emphasizing is how proudly overt this sentiment mm-hmm. is, mm-hmm. maybe in contrast to a decade ago and prior. It is certainly more ascendant and proud. And I think that's perhaps a reflection of, well, I mean, I don't want to speak too much. Judge, also, you don't seem like a different guy on the bench. I always enjoy talking to you.
And that's important. You know, I got to be the same guy. Otherwise, the people who elected me to have a diverse bench, if I'm somebody else, and you know, I'll be honest, I've gotten in a little bit of trouble over being the same guy. There's an adjustment you have to make, but we cannot sacrifice who we are. Otherwise, Jay Johnson's report is meaningless. I have to be consistent with all the rules that guide what we do as judges, but I have to be that Van White because otherwise we don't have a diverse bench.
Let me ask Andre Washington, treasurer of the Rochester Black Bar Association. So what do you make of this current political and cultural moment?
That is a very open-ended question. What do I make of it? I agree with you. Let me go backwards a little bit. What Judge White just said, I've been told since I can remember, I have to be 10 times better, not just one up, 10 times better. And so I work very hard, and I've always worked very hard, and it's kind of become a habit of practice just to see what everyone else is doing and to surpass that as many times over as I can. So what I have spent a lot of time thinking about in these last couple of years leading us to this moment is actually, what is diversity other than just representation? Because what I realized is the effort that I put into becoming who I am, the lawyer, the musician that I am today, is a measurement of all the hurdles that I had to overcome. And I noticed that that part of the conversation actually was not emphasized enough over a long period of time. So actually in law school, I spent about 2 years doing a lot of research on the case law and just on the social science research. And I decided that the diversity, the talk about diversity was in fact limited because it only talked about the differences between people to add more diversity of women or disability. But what it omitted to talk about was why that diversity was important, not only because representation, but perhaps that diversity represented a greater effort that particular person had to put into becoming who they are, right? The fact that if you studied for the LSAT in the neighborhood that is, you know, in the city, and I'm thinking about myself, in Chicago, right, where the library doesn't have the same kind of resources at the library of someone who's studying for the LSAT in a white neighborhood is. And that's just a small example where you have these daily experiences that people that come from different communities have to face. And when you don't look at those daily experiences and calculate them as to understanding how did they get from point A to point B, you're missing actually a really critical element of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember a conversation 5-6 years ago about representation in the sciences. And I'm thinking your comments, Andre, are making me recall some of the remarks on that program in which one of our guests said there's an irony that people like the Charlie Kirks might say, oh, well, there's a black pilot or here's a scientist and I hope they're qualified, as opposed to realizing that the idea is you don't have a lot of room to fail. You don't have a lot of room to misstep because the assumption from a lot of the people in power is that you might not be qualified to begin with. So you've got to be better. I mean, you have to overachieve almost. And instead, the public is seeing people in positions of authority, people of color, and thinking, well, I don't know if they're qualified, as opposed to realizing what you're describing, which is being taught from a young age, you're going to have to overperform if you want to get where you want to go.
Exactly. And it's also looking at what is the definition of the qualification in the first place. You brought up yourself, Pete Hegseth was appointed as the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
According to the qualifications that President Trump laid out, He, in fact, is the most qualified per Donald Trump's stated qualifications, which is loyalty to him. So what we have to look at is when we say what is merited, the definition of merit is really, it bakes in all of these things already. They bake in race, they bake in bias, they bake in loyalty to Trump or whatever. The determination, oh, I hope he's qualified, is I hope he can do the job, is really what the focus should be on. Because Pete Hegseth is qualified per Donald Trump because he's loyal to Trump, but can he do the job? Those are two different questions. And so when you have the diversity debate that is just at a high level, not digging into what is this person capable of doing, you're ignoring all of these different ways that you can actually assess individuals' capabilities.
We're talking to a panel about a series of events coming up as related to Black History Month and some efforts in the 7th Judicial District that is aimed at improving representation, improving services and community outreach, and all the different ways that our guests are talking about. And listeners, if you want to weigh in, you know how to find us. It's connections@wxxi.org. If you've got a question or a comment, connections@wxxi.org. You can jump in the chat on the YouTube page, WXXI News. Hello, if you're watching on there. Or you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It is 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you call from Rochester. 263-9994. Judge Reed, I also want to give you some space if you wanted to respond to some of whether it was the Charlie Kirk comments or just the notion of merit in general that we've been talking about.
Well, I just wanted to share an experience like what Judge White stated. As you know, when I was running, I also talked about that not only was I an immigrant, I came to this country, I had to learn how to speak English. But then also a few years after arrive, I ended up in foster care. So I became a ward of the state of California. And so I had certain experiences as an immigrant, as a foster child, as somebody who was a runaway, who was homeless, who lived on the streets. And so one of the things, and so why representation matters. And so one of the things that as a former foster child, as you will, that I wanted to make sure is that the voice of foster kids are also heard. We have a thing in family family court called permanency hearings. And I found when I first got on the bench, foster kids were not participating in permanency hearings. They get to have a voice in what happens with their case, whether they go home, whether they stay in foster care, whether they have a goal of, if they're 16 and over, eventually going to live on their own. And so because of my own experience, I said, you know what, we need to start a program where we can have foster kids come to the court, meet family court judges, tour the court, get a sense of what happens in the court, and be able to participate and have a voice in what happens with them in their future. And so because of my own experience, I thought it was important to start this program. And there's not a lot of judges who are on the bench who are former foster kids who sit on the family court bench. There's not a lot in New York State, and I guarantee there's not a lot across the United States. And so because of my experience, I said, I want to start this program, and we're going into our third year this year in which foster kids get to come to the courthouse, get to meet the family court judges, get to tour, and they get to participate in a mock permanency hearing. So they understand what their rights are. They understand that they can have a say in their future. So these are the types of things when we're talking about representation or when we're talking about access to justice and equal justice. And, you know, we might call me a DEI judge, but really what I'm focusing on is access to justice and equal justice. And so that's why, to me, it's important. That's why my representation was very important in family court and getting to the bench, because I'm able to share experiences and, you know, push for things based on what I've been through.
The story on foster care is pretty remarkable, because I think it really illustrates and maybe it helps me articulate something I've been thinking about with this, because I'm reading all of the national debate. Again, I try to read the good faith stuff and avoid the bad faith stuff, and there's a lot of both. But I don't hear you saying, look, my colleagues who haven't been through foster care are malicious or are, you know, excluding because they don't care. It's because absent that experience, it just might not be on the radar.
Correct.
And you can have a group of really good, hardworking people, but if all of the experiences and life backgrounds are the same, mm-hmm. that there is just naturally components that don't necessarily get included. Again, not out of malice, but that all of a sudden it's not represented.
Correct.
Is that the right way to
Absolutely.
Say it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that.
That's what I was trying to say about, I don't want to get into all her detail, but Judge Ackerman, who has spoken about her background, was brought up in a childhood youthful experience that I think was very difficult and challenging, as she describes it. And she created that court because she didn't want litigants to go into an environment without some support, that mentoring court. If I can just add one mm-hmm. other piece to this, mm-hmm. this conversation about whether you're a diverse person and whether you're qualified or not, and whether we should have these initiatives, here's another reason to have them. To the extent that people don't have in their experience an African-American, a Latino, a gay person, an Asian person, someone who's been through foster care, they don't have that experience, they may in fact buy into the narrative that those folks are not qualified. But the reason why you have a diverse bench, a diverse corporate board, a diverse employment application process, and hire diverse employees, is you then expose those naive or unexposed people to people who are qualified. So how long have you been on the bench?
About 6 years now.
6 years now. The benefit, not only to the people who are before her, the children that are before her, but to the people who now can see a person who is an immigrant, who is a mom, who is a judge, who is qualified and capable. Now they are educated, and these narratives that they hear from these folks that don't have a clue are now, well, oh yeah, wait a second, Van White, he's an African-American man, so he probably is not qualified, or Andre, he's probably not a qualified lawyer. Now they get to see over time and time again how diversity is meaningful, because it exposes people to qualified, capable professionals. That's the other reason why we must do this, because it gives America, people often say America is this melting pot. No, we're not a melting pot. We're stew. We got carrots. We got potatoes, and nothing's melting. We need to have those distinct flavors in there so people can see. And so when they see a diverse bench, they get the flavor of America.
All right, let me grab a phone call. I think this is Justice in Rochester. Go ahead.
Everybody. I just want to say, I don't know if this point was made, but as far as DEI, the first point I want to make is that many things can be true at the same time. And I think that's really, really important when talking about DEI, because on one end, talking too much about anything or too much of anything is not good. Right. And so as a person that has been on the front lines of this work, constantly always having my mind wrapped around race absolutely can be traumatic. Right. It can cause mental health issues, all sorts of things. Right. Because the world is just so much bigger than race. The world is beautiful. The world is colorful. It's full of so many different things. And so if you're navigating life always consistently engulfed in race, right, whether it be because you don't feel safe because of your identity or whatever, it can cause severe mental health issues, absolutely. So that's the first point I want to make. And then the second point I want to make is, if folks want to talk about getting rid of DEI, well, then we also have to talk about dismantling the racial hierarchy system that this society, this country, and damn near the entire world, excuse my language, is structured around. Right, whether it be the housing market, whether it be right the free labor that was extracted from Black folks right during slavery, right, race has always been at the foundation of how this country functions. So if you want to get rid of DEI, well then we got to get rid of the Black and white, right, and all of these different racial components that we all know are man-made and aren't of the natural world. The race ideology was created by those in power, right, to extract land, labor, and to push whatever, you know, agenda that they had. So that's the first That's the second thing I want to say. And then the third thing that I want to say is that, so to then say that, like, those who are most impacted by this racial hierarchy should, you know, stop talking about it so much, or that it should just be totally removed, is just preposterous. If you're not going to get at the root of the issue, then what you're doing is you're just putting a Band-Aid on this problem and never really addressing the inequity and the injustice that people on the other end of this racial hierarchy, meaning Black, brown, marginalized folks, are experiencing every single day. I think that that is missing from the conversation. Get rid of the racial hierarchies that this country benefits so much from.
Justice, thank you for the phone call. I'll go around the table. Andre, do you want to start? What do you make?
Oh, thank you. I was going to ask if I could respond.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first thing is, Justice, thank you, because you opened the door to something else that I wanted to say, which was a part of the conversation about diversity focuses only on some non-blame shifting kinds of conversations. While representation and diversity is important in system design, as Judge Reed talked about, and what the perspective that you bring to the court perhaps fills in gaps where others have blind spots. And Evan, you said, you know, what was interesting about that comment was that she didn't say that any of the other judges were malicious. I'm not about to say that. I don't believe that as with respect to Judge Reed's colleagues. However, what the caller just brought up is the reason this conversation even started in the first place in 1970, I can't remember, in Regents v. Baca, when the whole diversity rationale was come up with, was because we were in a part of American history when we were trying to dismantle deliberate structures that put up barriers to Black people owning property, going to school, and achieving any kind of, pursuit of happiness in the country. And when the Supreme Court had this case, using the word diversity was actually a cop-out. Because there was this fear of actually naming the thing, saying the thing that actually happened. Wrong was done, and these policies, affirmative action in particular in that case, was required to undo that wrong, right? And so if you actually embrace or acknowledge that some type of remedy, that you're going to pursue a certain kind of remedy, how are you going to pursue it? You are saying someone did something wrong, right? And so that's what the caller just opened the door up to, and I wanted to say I think what added to the frustration, in divestment in public education, you have all these folks that actually have literally no idea about America's history. Deliberately so, and we have to actually talk about that, and I think that's where you get your power toward what the correct remedy is. We've been fighting at straws with this diversity part. I also think that what Justice brought up, thinking about race too much causing mental health issues, it's true in that what was it, James Baldwin? You know, I'm enraged all the time. Because I'm a Black man in America and I know what's going on.
Judge Reed, you want to add to that?
I mean, Andre hit the point that I wanted to get to. I just wanted to take a little detour with what Justice mentioned in terms of the mental health capacity of talking about race or being someone who always has to be better, who always has to do better. And how that is impactful on some of us people of color, and I can only speak from my perspective as a Black woman, knowing that I have to behave a certain way when I'm in different groups. If I need something done, I have to make sure that I'm not perceived as aggressive. Because that'll be the first thing that I would be called is that I, you know, she's too aggressive. If I was, you know, a white man, and I, you know, wanted
You'd be a patriot.
I would be. And so I just thought that was very interesting that Justice did bring that up, because that does create an issue for some of us in our community, is that some of us then can engage in harmful behavior to ourselves as well, because there is that, you know, mental health aspect of having to deal with race and having to constantly prove that you're good enough.
Judge White?
Yeah, so, okay, I'm going to take you through real time what it's like to be a person of color in a conversation about diversity. I'm struggling with whether I want to say what needs to be said, because if I do, people might think, oh, he's this radical. And I think most people know me over my career in public service would not describe me as radical, but I'm going to say it anyway.
But also remember our judicial ethics.
No. This has nothing to do with this. This has nothing to do with
your
that.
I appreciate that warning.
I appreciate that warning. But again, what's the point of having a diverse bench or a diverse show about diversity if you can't say what is on your mind? And this is the truth. And most black folks think this. What's all this conversation about DEI and it being an unfair leg up for people when for centuries, white men have had the opportunity to elevate their cousins, their sons, their daughters to corporate positions, to government positions, to give them contracts, redlining? This stuff has been happening for decades and nobody complained about it. Now all of a sudden, somebody says, in addition to being competent and capable, we want to recognize the value of who you are as a person culturally, ethnically, right? So I want to tell you, this conversation is an example of the struggles we have, not as judges. This has nothing to do about ethics or anything like that. This is a struggle. When do we speak the truth to power? And I want to say, to speak the truth to power, for those folks talking about, wait a second, do these people actually deserve to be pilots? Do they deserve to be in the air controller room? I'm telling you, for decades, nobody asked that question when they were putting white men in positions of power that were controlling people's lives. Now, all of a sudden, they want to have that conversation. And I'm saying, no, we're not having that conversation. Everybody in this room is qualified, capable, and committed to provide public service to the citizens of this community in the legal form. But on top of that, we value the diversity of who we are, and we hope you value that too, because our systems of government can only be improved to the extent that the people who are charged with executing those powers do it in a way that's sensitive, that's empathetic, that's understanding. That's particularly government. That's what government should be about.
We are late for our only break of the hour.
Oh.
And that's okay. Let's do that. Let's take that break. We're going to come right back. I've got a little more feedback from the audience. I want to make sure you understand the events that are coming up later in the month. One event next week, one the following, and we'll come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, most Americans are not vegan, but most Americans, according to surveys, say that they want to eat a lot more plant-based food, even if it's not a full vegan diet. So, why aren't more of us actually doing that? Is there an issue in the marketplace in terms of restaurants and food that's available? Or do we just not know where to get it? You're going to meet two business owners who think there is a big hole in that marketplace next hour. This is Connections. We've been talking about making our courts inclusive and representative for the community. The Honorable Fatima Reed is with us. Judge Reed is a family court judge. The Honorable Van White is a Rochester City Court judge. Andre Washington is treasurer of the Rochester Black Bar Association. Tom writes in to say three different times he's given a standing ovation and our guest can't even see him. So that's from Tom. Tim had a different view. He said that we are missing some of what has driven the conversation on race in recent years. He says so much feels like everything is so extreme and so loaded. He points to the work of Ibram X. Kendi. He says, Kendi's books, which, by the way, include a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist, his books say, look, everyone is either anti-racist or racist in everything they do. And you are turning people off if you tell them that everything in political and civic life is either racist or anti-racist. I'm buttering a piece of toast. Is that racist or anti-racist? Why are we always thinking about everything in terms of race? That is from Tim. So I don't know if the judges can weigh in on that. I'll ask Andre what you make of that email. What do you think?
My initial reaction is I hear a lot of folks. So I went to the University of Chicago Law School, I want to say that, which is where the Federalist Society was founded. The architects of a lot of people that are looking to destroy our democracy right now and who espouse a lot of beliefs as anti-diversity. And so I've gotten very intimate with these points of views. And so my first thought when someone says that Ibram X. Kendi, for example, is extreme, is really kind of a lack of depth of understanding through which to receive, a lens through which to receive the information. Right. And so I think the absurdity of the remark is evidenced by the example that Tim, is that his name?
Tim.
Chose by talking about buttering his toast. I mean, that's completely unserious in terms of an example. However, if you actually take in the information and like read the book, and then you see all the ways in which society and life is in fact infected with race, you'll see what that statement actually means, in that the way cities are designed, the way school funding actually works, the way hiring works, the way people select their mate, it was quite fascinating to me in talking about the design of a few years, about 10 or so years ago. You may have experienced this when you go to the bathroom and you wave your hand under the soap dispenser, mm-hmm. without the touching soap dispenser. They designed it only testing white hands, and they weren't responsive to black hands. Right. And so
I never saw that story.
Technological designs when this is known with health, which is the problem with what President Trump is doing in omitting reference to race in looking in health research. When you're not including the diversity of people, race impacts so much of how life works in America. And so when Ibram X. Kendi says that you're either racist or anti-racist, I will say what I hear from that is that the structure has been designed. I mean, it's in our Constitution that I'm technically only 2/3 of a person. The structure was designed with that in mind. And so either if you're not consciously aware of it, you're just being shaped by the structure around you. And so you are impacting and acting by just living in a racist society and absorbing these ideas. Or you can be, and this is, you know, not welcome to be said, or you can be woke to the structure that we live in and be anti-racist. That's what I think Ibram X. Kendi is talking about. Does it have anything to do with buttering toast? No, but I think like making that comparison is just not a serious look at the depth of the problem.
Do you think people have been turned off by feeling exhausted by thinking about race all the time, or is that a white-centered question? I mean, I'm not trying to use the language of the movement. I'm asking honestly because, Andre, I feel like when I ask you, do you think people get exhausted by talking about race all the time? You've already said this hour, like, you know, if you're growing up as a black man, being told you've got to work 10 times harder, you're thinking about it all the time inherently. And it might be easy for white people to be like, this is kind of exhausting.
I think it's exhausting for white people because it's new. It is not something that they actually have to think about. It is a privilege to not have to think about that who you are or the way you look will actually impact your life. Until recently, like what Judge Reed talked about, when you are, you know, I didn't regret it, but I immediately regretted when I quoted James Baldwin. It's like, oh my God, this angry black man on the radio, the thing is, it might be exhausting for white people, but take that exhaustion, think about it, and then imagine what it's like when you are on the receiving end of the actual oppression, and there is no escape to how the structure is is impacting on your body.
So let me interpret Tim's email one other way. Do you think DEI has overstepped or misstepped in any way?
So in my honest opinion, I think the word diversity has misstepped because it doesn't actually name the thing. I mentioned that earlier, and I think that created problems because you're talking about a solution without actually talking about the problem. So I think that becomes that does become confusing because people are like, well, what are we doing? Why are we fixing this? Why are we fixing that? Why are you fixing this? Right? I think that that does create some confusion. I think that it has been intentionally exploited to cause its downfall, actually.
In what way?
Well, we don't have enough time to get into it. But there is a law professor, Osamudia James, who writes about the problem of diversity and how what it does is it creates this oppositional relationship to whiteness and everything else. Right. And I think what it causes is this sense of targeting whiteness as the problem rather than white supremacy. Right. It has diminished the depth of the conversation that needs to happen. And so it becomes this oppositional thing, whereas it really, at the end of the day, if we talk about like housing policy, for example, white people got their houses. We're not saying take the houses away. We're saying give the houses to us too, right? And so, without that full conversation, it does become this oppositional non-understanding of what came before. So the missteps, I think, has been in a failure to actually name the thing.
Anything our guests across the table want to add or feel like they can add? Judges?
I would just say, you know, people can talk about DEI and this from a programmatic point of view, but really, the reality is, whether you're a judge, a lawyer, a corporate executive officer, you got to live the life of tolerance and appreciating what America, as I said, the pot of filled with vegetables has to give to each and every one of us. And when you witness it over time, when you taste it over time, that diversity, that what's in that pot, there can be a better appreciation of how America can be better. So, you know, forget the conversation, forget the narratives that people are trying to put out there from a political perspective. I'm not even talking about that. When I get on the bench every morning, I'm taking Sam White with me. I'm taking Anna White with me. I'm taking my brothers, my sisters, the schools that I went to. I'm taking the fact that I was a prosecutor. I'm taking the fact that I'm a dad. That's the diversity that Judge Ackerman brings, her background that Judge Reed brings, that Andre brings into the courtroom. So forget the dialogue, the narratives, this is bad, this is right, let's go left, let's go right. Just do your job and appreciate what America has to offer in that pot.
All right, we've got to keep it tight here. About 30 seconds, Wyatt in Brighton on the phone. Hey, Wyatt, go ahead.
Oh, it's Wyant.
Oh, Wyant, go ahead. Yep, go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm from Illinois, and I just want to say, listen, I appreciate you having this panel. I just want to say, as a teacher, people, your ethnic people, need to educate themselves because it's super, super important. We cannot take off our skin. We live in this skin, and we make sure that we perform above and beyond. We know our history, your history. Can you just take the time and learn American history? That is the diversity of us all. I think that would just the first step, maybe just the one of the first steps that we need to do to help to attack this problem. Thank you so much for having your panel. Thank you for what you do. And to all the young ones out there, keep your head up, learn your history, and maintain your humanity.
Wyatt, thank you very much for taking the time to call in here. Appreciate that. And it has been a very fast hour. The reason we got together in the first place is there's two events that they wanted you to know about. And so I think Wyant's phone call puts a little button on the conversation, and then we'll close this by making sure you know what's coming up here. 6 days from now, February 18th, the Little Theater is hosting, starting at 5:45, A free community screening of Greenwood is still burning. It's a documentary recounting the 1921 Tulsa race massacre and the impact on Black Wall Street. The film is followed by a panel discussion. That is next Tuesday at The Little, 5:45. Get there early. They would love to see you there. And then 8 days after that, 2 weeks from today, February 26th, starting at just after noon at the Hall of Justice, fourth floor, Judge, you said?
Yes, fourth floor.
On the fourth floor. Tell people what's coming up on that day.
So on the fourth floor, we're going to have an amazing panel discussion of local labor leaders, since the theme this year for Black History Month is African Americans and labor. And so we wanted to educate ourselves, educate our community, people who look like us, who don't look like us, about the African American movement in labor. And so we're looking forward to having everyone there.
I want to say it is, there's a reason we don't often get a chance to sit down with sitting judges. There are limits on what they can talk about, what they can respond to. And I always appreciate it. Our community appreciates it. Listeners do. It is a wonderful opportunity to have a conversation with some of the leaders in this community. And Judge Fatima Reed, an honor. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for making the time. Judge Van White, thank you very much. Nice to see you. Another 5 years, I'll see you again, apparently, something like that.
It doesn't have to be that long.
Andre Washington, treasurer of the Rochester Black Bar Association, thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
We've got more connections coming up in just a moment.